Welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, presented by Cooper Tires and our Week in IndyCar episode. Our guest this time, two-time Indy 500 winner, Ari Lyandike. I love Ari. He is, I would say, the racing driver equivalent of my good pal Robin Miller in many ways. The absolute unvarnished truth. Doesn't necessarily always share that in public or in print or in this case in podcast form, but I tell you what, the man pulls no punches, tells you exactly what he thinks, and beyond his phenomenal skill as a race car driver and even as a race director today as a race steward, I love the fact that I can get together with Ari whenever, and yeah, boy, there is no sugarcoating with him. So hopefully you'll enjoy our call here in just a little bit. As usual, I'm going to run through a couple of recent news items, get to our favorite question from last week, and get someone a Marshall Pruitt Podcast Week in IndyCar t-shirt, cover off the questions you have all sent me, and then we'll get into Ari and all the questions you have sent in for he and I to get through. Looks like things are starting to settle down a little bit at Schmidt-Peterson Motorsports. Piers Phillips, general manager over the last 3 years. Hearing a little bit more about how things took place, know it was a definite surprise that he was looking elsewhere and ended up heading out to take, frankly, a very similar position, a new position, president of Ray Hall Letterman Lanigan Racing. So you could say that Piers effectively has moved from one team to the other, doing essentially the same role. Big difference, though, you could say, is now that at the house of Bob and Mike and David, he will also be looking over their IMSA sports car team, which is really a big motivation for Piers. I know he wants to get back to Le Mans, so I think that's all going to work out well for him. But with this somewhat unexpected decision to change teams, obviously Taylor Kyle, he's jumped into that general manager role. I think he's going to do an excellent, excellent job there. He has the heart of the SPM team for sure. And we also have Marcus Ericsson coming in. I think this is going to be 2019 is going to be another interesting year for this team. Obviously, we all wish that Robert Wickens was still in the number six car, because what's the one thing that they really have not had at Schmidt-Peterson Motorsports? That's serious consistency with two front-running drivers working together for two consecutive years. Hinch has obviously had teammates that he has worked with for more than 1 year in the past. I can't say that there was something really there with those teammates where, aha, all right, this is going to be a really strong 1-2 punch. They just need to keep gelling, keep building. And so here we are back. Effectively starting over with Marcus Ericsson coming in. No slight or disrespect to Marcus at all, just as an organization that was showing really big things, like they were going to expand what we call the Big Three: Andretti Autosport, Chip Ganassi Racing, and Team Penske. Expand that out to four with SPM entered into that mix. Not quite sure if we're going to see that happen in 2019, with Marcus having to learn basically every track, learn oval driving. He and Hinch need to figure out how to work together. I'm sure they will, but again, that doesn't happen overnight. There's no real familiarity. It's just they are winding the clock back farther than they really and truly wanted to, knowing how far things actually progressed in 2018. A couple of other interesting little things that I've heard. Not saying they're accurate, but also not saying they're completely false, but heard a pretty interesting suggestion that co-owner Rick Peterson, who's Canadian, who is definitely a big driver behind Robert Wickens coming in, and also some of the funding behind that, if not a lot of the funding behind that, that he'd said, hey, if we can find another Canadian driver that is of similar stature, similar quality to Robert, I'll keep putting in what I've been putting in, but if not, go ahead and open that car back up and you guys find a driver who brings a budget with him or with her. And if we look at what they have with Marcus, they have definitely satisfied that second scenario. Thinking about the Canadian side, though, interesting. Is there anybody on the Canadian side who is really ready and chomping at the bit to jump in and try and be that interim Robert Wickens. Scott Hargrove came to mind, kid who won an Indy Lights, came up the Mazda Road to Indy, had to jump off a couple years ago, but 2 years ago maybe, maybe three if I'm completely forgetting, but had to jump off a couple years ago for lack of funding. He's been in sports cars, just really, truly tore things up in 2018 in the Pirelli World Challenge Series. I look at Scott and always thought, with the right team, with some more time to develop, we had another big Canadian talent in the making. Daniel Morad as well. He's someone who was really quick back in the day in his open wheel career. He's been just as impressive in sports cars, so I don't know if there was an effort to talk to those two, an interest to maybe go test and see, but if Rick was indeed willing and interested in putting money behind another Canadian to have an all-Canadian team, tell you, Hargrove first, and then Morad right behind him, certainly would have been two that were high on my radar. Moving over to the Dale Coyne Racing team, been waiting and wondering why we haven't had official confirmation of Sebastian Bourdais and Santino Ferrucci as teammates for 2019, and a little birdie tells me that we might finally be getting that confirmation this week, and if not next week, and it was supposed to be last week, and maybe the week before, so don't hold me to this one. I'm just going off of a little bit of background information, but I believe we're going to finally have them confirmed publicly, at least. We've been telling you for a long time that Seb's re-signed and that Santino signed up for 2019 as well, but just waiting for the team to come out and also say that is indeed the truth. All right, let's get to my favorite question of the week, and that came from David Nixick when we had Craig Hampson on last week. And David thankfully opened up a fun conversation. Said, Craig, can you explain how a 7-post rig is used for development? Can you simulate specific tracks for setup? And if so, how is the track modeled on the 7-post rig? So that opened up some good stuff. Learned a lot. Always learn a lot with Craig. Got to have him on more often. And so, David, send me a direct message on Facebook. Give me your address and give me your t-shirt size. And we will have our friends at TorontoMotorsports.com, the ones who make the Week in IndyCar and the Week in Sports Car t-shirts. Our friends there will be sure to send you a t-shirt of your choosing in whatever size there. So again, thanks to our pals at TorontoMotorsports.com, and also thank you to David for the great question. All right, let's dive into the ones you sent in for me before we get to our man, Mr. Leyendyk. We're going to open up with one from Ed Joris, who says, do you think that Felix Rosenqvist's experience in Formula E will give him a leg up on energy conservation, making fuel in IndyCar? And could he teach Scott Dixon a thing or two? Great question, Ed. Do I think that Felix will be on the more advanced learning curve side of fuel conservation? Yes. Do I think he's going to be able to teach Scott a thing or two? I really don't. I would be very surprised if that was the case. As we know, Scott's been the man in terms of saving fuel pretty much his entire career. Started around 2004, 2005 or so with the Toyota IRL engine, which wasn't making as much power as its rivals. So the only real thing they could do was figure out ways to save fuel, give themselves more opportunities and pit windows, and see if they could sneak a win in here or there. So that's the popular history there. Where I think the art has really been changed in a way that maybe hasn't been discussed too much. I don't even know if Dixon would, if he would want to do a story on this or what, but this has changed. Definitely changed, I would say, more than I've noticed it, at least, over the last couple of years, where instead of it being, hey, we're going to try and go long, and instead of this being a three-stop race like everyone else is doing, we're going to try and do it on two, and Scott, I need you to do some really remarkable things behind the wheel to save that fuel. He does that when necessary, obviously, does it well. The thing that I've seen him doing more and more of is just straight-up fuel saving, period, from when the green flag waves all the way to the very end. Even if it isn't needed from a strategy standpoint. And when I say standpoint, I mean, okay, could we save a little bit of extra fuel and that'll open up a window and maybe let us jump ahead of someone because of some big grand plan? No. What I've seen more of, and it's really come from watching Pit Stop Duration, it's that, well, hey, even if we're not on a fuel run and really trying to be miserly with every little drop, what if I can effectively go as fast as everyone else, maybe even a little bit faster, while still saving fuel without having a direct need for it? And then when it comes time to do a pit stop, well, my tank's a little bit more full than everyone else. It's going to take a little bit less time to fill it. How can I incorporate, just call it permanent fuel saving, into my driving and then use that during pit stops to gain a significant advantage? Leapfrog a car or two just because we were on pit lane 1 second less than everyone else, or 0.4. I think the thing that Scott's been doing, except for some instances where he's just had enough fuel, and obviously if he's got plenty to run to the end, he's going to burn all that he can, but I think the thing Dixie's been doing that really jumped out the last, I'd say, 2 years is, they have gained the system even more here in knowing that when they do need to come to pit lane, on most instances, there is a need for Scott to sit on pit lane for less time than the rest. You start factoring that in race after race after race. That's why that team has been so dominant on pit lane, on top of the phenomenal work led by Blair Julian and the entire pit crew there. But yeah, I think there's something here. I think Dixon's onto something where, man, race-long fuel conservation, at least up to and through the final stop. I'd be curious to see if that becomes more of a baked-in thing for other teams, too. Next question goes to Daniel Kincaid. He says, kind of long and maybe confusing question here. On the topic of dampers last week, it got me wondering, who owns the rights to the designs? Does the individual who designs them, or does the organization own the rights? He says, I'm assuming the employees sign non-disclosure agreements, but does that mean they must give up their intellectual property rights on designs? Daniel says, an example would be if Joe worked at Penske and designs their shock absorbers and gets another job at Ganassi, does Joe own the rights to his damper design to take to the new team, or does the Penske organization own the rights? Well, the real answer to that, Daniel, is contracts. No team has the same contract. Every team and every employee will either ask for or agree to different things. So there's not an industry standard, but I would say that we can safely assume that good old Joe here, working at Penske, designing damper whatever parts and pieces for them, if not the entire units, I would say the good old Joe would certainly be under very, very heavy restrictions that would prevent him from taking that IP to another team. Would Penske, if they lost Joe to Ganassi, then sue Ganassi and ask to see the insides of their dampers to then compare and contrast to see if it is indeed the same exact thing that Joe designed for them? I don't think so. I just think that in cases like this, We have some folks who know some really, really good things, and teams do not want to let those things leave. Outside of dampers, I've definitely heard of, an assistant engineer leaving one team, going to another, and, hey, it looks like they brought all of our setup sheets with them, or all of our, name something that is a sensitive piece of information about what makes one team successful, and then bringing it to another. I think that happens enough to where, yeah, there are certainly private areas that nobody knows how you do this or how you do that, but I also think it ends up being just a big old gumbo, a pot of gumbo at some point where, everybody's information in some way has kind of made the rounds. Back to this case, though, Daniel, certainly there would be a lot of safeguards put in place. If you leave us, you cannot work, in a damper capacity, in any capacity in the same profession for a year, 2 years, something, to let the march of time move on so that whatever thing team was using in 2018 would be maybe a little bit old news by 2020. So, yeah. But at the same time, you also have folks that say, hey, if you're really doing big things like this, We want to make sure we give you all the incentives so you don't want to leave and go somewhere else. But back to the primary question, it's truly down to the contracts written. It wouldn't be a blanket thing. Next, we'll go to Daniel Eckersley. He says, Marshall, any idea if Jordan King will be back for 2019? Could he be in line for at least a partial season at Carlin? He says, he, like most young Brits, has history with the team, so it seems like a good fit. I've heard Jordan's name mentioned very lightly with Carlin. I think we'll see him in something for the Indy 500. I don't know at this stage if we're going to hear more than the Indy 500 for Jordan, which would be too bad, because I like that kid, and I think he showed some genuine potential, a lot of it unrealized. Definitely would need to take whatever he's able to do in qualifying and get to the end of the race in a similar position. Went backwards a lot. It wasn't all his fault by any means, but would definitely like to see Jordan, if he could be, full-time in 2019 to get a feel for what kind of talent he has to offer. But at this point, Daniel, not hearing a lot about partial season or even full-time for him, so definitely a concern there. Ryan Terpstra asks a question for MP. How's Robin doing? Some of you might know that our man Robin Miller is undergoing medical treatments right now, and since Robin has not volunteered any information about that, I would not be the one to then offer it in his place, because that is his information. So thank you for asking, Ryan. I'm not going to report on how Robin's doing if the man himself has not. Nick Parker says, for Marshall, has there been any word about the IndyCar digital displays on the roll hoops making a return next year? And he says, has any progress been reported on fixing the issues they had earlier in this past season? I was texting with IndyCar competition president Jay Fry yesterday, Monday, Nick, on this very question for you, and he said that they're having a meeting on Friday about this and would have more to offer after that. So wasn't in a place to answer whether they're coming back or finding issues, fixing issues, but did say that they're going to have a meeting on it on Friday. And I believe the last state that I heard, it was in a position of trying to find a new and different vendor. So we'll get back to you, Nick, here whenever I get a word back from Jay. We're going to go to Henry Erbach next. Says, hello, it's been about 80 days since Robert Whitkin's incident. Any news regarding the fencing, new design or inspection of track facilities regarding safety? And will tracks be required to have certified welders, supplies, and a structural engineer on site during an event? Fix this. I echo your sentiment, Henry. I haven't heard anything. This is another thing I need to, of the many things, this is near the top of things that I need to get on top of with IndyCar and find out if there are going to be any new policies. We do know that they, IndyCar, and the track, Pocono, was fairly forthright in saying they were comfortable and confident in the quality of the repairs that were made after Robert's crash. I think most people with eyeballs would say, really? But yeah, they seemed to say all was good, everything was okay. What I've been thinking about is, frankly, very similar to your line of thought here, Henry, of is there going to be anything better? Is there going to be any new layer of oversight, of evaluation, something? Or will we just be left to whatever track has for either repair items or how things are done? And, you know, IndyCar safety team, I know, took a look at things. And, I mean, there are a lot of folks who looked at it and were in agreement. But, you know, do we have somebody who is a structural engineer who can truly say, yes, that will do the job? Or is it just a bunch of experienced folks who say, yeah, based on what I've seen, that should be fine? And is that enough? All questions that I hope to put to Jay here soon to find out if Robert's crash will lead to any changes on how they get down with fencing, track repairs, and so on. Last question here goes to Daniel Mack, who says, with the struggle for entries on the road to Indy going forward, would it be better if all cars were run under one roof by IndyCar rather than the teams, not unlike Jonathan Palmer's Formula 2, and back in the day, the Formula Palmer Audi? And Daniel also says, would this make each entry for a driver cheaper? Maybe a long-term solution rather than an overnight fix. I'd say that We definitely saw Indy Lights was struggling for numbers, Daniel. I wouldn't say that all three steps of the ladder were struggling for entries. IndyCar, until they handed it off to Anderson Promotions, was in charge of Indy Lights back when it was the, I guess what we would call the Infinity Pro Series, up to the change that ultimately soon led to the new Dallara Isle 15. So IndyCar was in charge of that and decided it would be better to hand that off to someone else. I think that decision, Daniel, might tell us something, that they're doing the best with what they have in IndyCar and the budget they have to do that. I don't think the money is there for IndyCar to take all this on to be the one-stop shopping, the one roof where everything is run under. I don't know if it would be cheaper. I would just say that Dan Anderson and his team with the Road to Indy, I believe they know more than ever that the costs must come down. They have worked with IndyCar to come up with ways to bring costs down at every level, especially Indy Lights. And it's not because they are doing things wrong or bad. It's because people's willingness to spend the big money that has been spent over the years, that is the thing that has changed of late. So modifying the buy-in price to participate on the Road to Indy, that to me seems to be the big change that needs to happen. And whether it's making things cheaper in terms of the cars and operating costs or running fewer rounds, whatever it is that brings budgets into line with what folks can afford, that changes, you know, as the economy changes and fluctuates. Same with the ability and willingness for folks to spend whatever that number is each year. And I'd say the big takeaway here, I would say, is not shifting everything over to IndyCar and having them run it. I think Anderson Promotions is doing a fine job there. Just as Dan has said, they need to do a better job of modifying themselves, being faster to react to the market, and make sure that they're hitting a price or giving their teams an opportunity to hit a price that more folks can afford and get on the grid. Next, we'll go to Pamela Henderson. This is coming in via Reddit. I love the screen names. Marshall, any comment on the allegations against Paul Tracy? Probably going to keep this one shorter than usual, not because I've known Paul for a long time, not for any reasons that you might think, just this is a mess that he has made, and he claims that he was not the person who wrote the items regarding immigration and rape and whatnot, and if that is true, then good for him. It would represent a pretty awesome and amazing and unexpected turnaround in character for Paul. He has, over the years, written, I don't know how many, I've lost track of how many really hard or just dark things on social media, been called out for them, has then deleted them. He has been subject of a few instances like this where someone got really mad or upset about something that he has posted specifically on social media. And I'm not just talking about fans or people he's interacted with, folks in the industry, possibly those who employ him, who've told him to tone things down, cut that stuff out, not just, you know, political stuff, just in general. Hey, do you really need to be that aggressive, that mean-spirited? And I think for the most part, we've seen a lot of that get cleaned up since that was passed down. I guess what I'd come back to here is he claims he didn't do it. Do I think that is factual? No, not based on history. He has used the I've been hacked excuse enough times for it to be very much an instance of crying wolf yet again. So if this is the one time where he wasn't, which nobody that I've spoken to, just call it inside the family, believes, he is being judged unfairly. But it's not as if a precedent hasn't been set over and over again online, all by his own doing, right? This isn't some just fantasy stuff. This isn't a first case. This is a many case scenario. So again, if by chance someone did actually post that instead of him, then good for him. And maybe whatever darkness there is inside of him that seems to come out on whatever occasion on social media, maybe he's turned a page and is evolving as a person. And again, this has nothing to do with red state, blue state, left, I mean, purely non-political. This is just social media, and for all of those, all of us on it, we have a decision to make of what side of ourselves do we share? What do we expose about ourselves? Paul, like myself, likes to stir things up a little bit. That's part of our personality. Not saying I do that on social media very much, but for those who know me, those that I'm friends with in real life, you know, love to poke the bear. That's fun. It's a fun part of life for me. And we could say the same thing about Paul. We definitely have seen that in his driving throughout the years. The old chrome horn, you know, a Paul Tracy race without contact was a strange one. And it's just, that's part of who he is, that agitator guy. And that's fine. Again, there's nothing wrong there. I'm guilty of it myself. Just you have to ask yourself, since you're speaking to thousands, millions, who knows how many online, what message about yourself do you want to convey? And in this instance, I think we're seeing someone who not only pushed back and said, hey, this is too far from me, has also gone the route, which I'm not very fond of these days, which is, and now I'm going to try and take your employment away from you. This, I'm not defending Paul in any way when I say that. I haven't been a fan of that move for years. That, I think, is a pretty weak thing in general that gets done a lot by folks these days. But regardless, Paul put himself in this situation. That is my takeaway here. And knowing that he has been warned, knowing that he's been told not to, it's really hard to argue against this being accurate, given the past history of all the things that he's said, all the things that he's done. Last thing I'll mention here that I've heard, can't say it's 100% accurate, but I believe it might be, is I believe a new contract would need to be extended to him, maybe some others on the broadcast side, to return in 2019. That meaning out of contract. I know that the TV stuff is not, by any stretch of the imagination, the way that he supports himself. He has other businesses, other interests. It's something that he does because he enjoys it. So the part of trying to take away employment opportunities, again, I don't think even if he does lose, quote, lose this, I don't think it's going to affect his life in any way financially, the ability to pay bills, send kids to school, etc. But yeah, sometimes we have hard lessons visited upon us, especially ones when we've been warned, hey man, don't do this, stop doing this. And if we insist on continuing to do it, or even just put in a situation where if we didn't do it, it looks like we did, one way or the other. No one else created the situation but Paul. Let's go to Counterbalanced Cove 2, who says, apologies that this has been asked before. Marshall, what do you think is the biggest hurdle IndyCar needs to jump for the series and its driver to regain the respect it deserves in the wider motorsports world? And if there is such a hurdle, do you think it's possible to cross it in a world where motorsport has become a niche thing and fans of series tend to only watch one form of car racing and ignore the others? A lot of stuff packed in there. I think there's a couple of assumptions here. I wouldn't say that, you know, we necessarily have a thing where I like NASCAR and exclude everything else. I like IndyCar and exclude everything else. I think it might actually be a little bit of the opposite, where at least for me growing up, there were pretty heavy divisions. And nowadays, with the ready access to so many things, especially via streaming, you know, you can follow the V8 supercars down under pretty closely. It's even on TV here. You can watch this, you can watch that. I think access, if anything, has maybe opened up folks' interests in more than just one series than maybe they would have traditionally followed in the past. On the respect thing, and IndyCar getting to be a bigger thing, they're headed down an interesting road where, with the plans that they've announced for the 2021 engine, and I'm guessing whatever's going to come with a new chassis in 22, IndyCar has said, yeah, we're not really going to jump into this electrification hybrid stuff that is so much a part of sports car racing. We have it in Formula One, obviously, with the use of hybrid systems there. IndyCar has doubled down on just old school power, combustion engine power. And I think that will actually be the differentiator. The question being, though, is does that fit where the world's going and what new fans who might be interested in racing would think fits their sensibilities? I don't have an answer to that, but I would say that that is definitely the big question in terms of getting respect, more interest, wider embracement throughout the world of racing. Will IndyCar, being what Jay Fry calls the fast and loud series with 900 plus horsepower and just trying to be rockets, pure entertainment, will that be something that draws in new fans and grows wider appreciation for what's happening here? Or, in a couple years' time, will we have others saying, yeah, boy, you guys really missed the boat. Why don't you have some sort of electrification, some sort of hydrogen this? Where's the modernization, IndyCar? And why has time passed you by? That's, to me, the real question. So it's a gamble, too. I've written about it. I've mentioned it on the podcast before. I love the idea. I mean, as someone who loves the WWE and mixed martial arts and other things where, you know, it's a pretty simple, basic thing of either hardcore competition or hardcore entertainment, this is just really saying we're going to be sports entertainment. We're not trying to solve the world's problems. We're not trying to bring new innovations into the automotive sector. We just want to be fast and loud. And I know that appeals to the older fan base. I don't know if that's going to connect with a younger fan base or have younger folks in general say, yeah, okay, pal, whatever. I'm going to turn on Formula E or the FIAWEC or IMSA or something else that makes me feel as if we're not just polluting the world and doing nothing. So I think that's the real answer. But I do know that at least within the general world of motor racing inside, that IndyCar is only being spoken of in very positive mentions in most areas. The cars are, you know, hard to drive, they're quick, it's a multi-discipline thing. All these things have been around for a while, but I think with the cars now looking better and just driver quality higher than ever, I know that when you go elsewhere, you hear folks say, boy, it seems like they're heading in the right direction in so many ways. So I think it's got the respect, but in terms of the growth and where it's going, it's going to be a moratorium. There's going to be a strong understanding by 21, 22 or so, whether IndyCar is on the right path with the decisions it's made, or if there's going to need to be a rapid change to incorporate hybridization, modern technology that isn't currently in use, and other things that really bring technology and conservation into the equation as well. All right, with all that said, let's get going with our man, Ari Leyendyke. Ari, I always love our conversations. As I mentioned to folks in my little cold open, you are a man who just says it like it is, and of the many reasons we love you, that's definitely one of them. Got a lot of great questions that have come in, so why don't we go ahead and jump into things? I've broken them into sections because they did fall a little thematically. So why don't we kick off with some Indy 500 questions for you, starting with one from Zachary Campbell. He says, Ari, can you describe the shock of coming around to get lap 200 in the 1997 Indy 500 and see the green flag with the white flag? He says, did you ever think about it or ponder what would have happened if you weren't paying attention?
Yeah, it was a shock for sure. The reason I didn't screw up that day and just kind of automatically thought, oh, well, we're going to finish on the yellow, is because in 1990, I was getting lapped. Well, I wasn't getting lapped. Emerson was unlapping himself by passing me going into turn one. So I was looking in my mirrors where he was at, and I kind of moved over to the right, and I let him go because there was one more lap to go. And so I never saw the white flag.
Hmm.
And then I came around the next time, and there's the checked flag, and I go, oh, yeah, that's right, yeah, because I missed the white flag. So this time I was coming up towards the the flag stand, and I go, you know what? I looked at that stand like that was my only focus, to see that white flag, because I wanted to make sure that, you know, it was done the way it was supposed to be done. So as I'm looking at the stand, expecting the white flag while the yellow was still going on, and I actually had gone up another gear just to kind of like putz around and I don't know, it's an automatic thing. When you're on the yellow, you go up to the highest gear to save fuel, and it's kind of an automatic thing. And also we were, I don't remember if I changed the fuel setting, but I probably did. So as I'm looking at the flag stand, I see all of a sudden the green. I'm like, holy shit. And I'm grabbing gears to go down gears, and the car was a difficult car to shift anyway. The new IRL car, the gearbox wasn't the best. And that was a difficult car to shift gears. And so off I went. And I was expecting to be gobbled up by Scott Goodyear and by maybe more guys, because I thought, wow, I totally was in the wrong gear. And I'm here, I'm trying to get the thing up to speed. But everybody else was caught out. And, of course, they made a big drama about it. Scott Goodyear lost another race because of this and that, but basically it was my race to lose and his to win in the end. But he as I were, we were both caught off guard big time, as was everybody else. So it was status quo. Everybody finished where they started that previous lap, so it finished the way it was supposed to finish.
Brian Ullman asks, as Ari's two wins at Indy were very different in the equipment packages that you used, one being a 1990 Lola Chevy, the other being a 90 Lola Chevy, the other being a 97 G-Force Oldsmobile. Brian says he'd be curious to get a sense of how the two cars impacted your approach to managing each of your race wins, maybe in terms of tire wear, fuel management strategy. So that's an interesting one. These two very different machines you used to win, how did you treat them, or did you have to manage them differently to get to the checkered flag?
Well, you do manage every car different basically every year, because the big difference 1990 and 97 was the cars were so much different, and but we also had good years in 1990, and we had Firestones in 1997, so a lot of things are different. And the approach comes with basically the day you roll out of the pits and you start testing the car in the weeks leading up to the race and the week leading up to qualifying. So every day is basically a new challenge, and you adapt as you go along. So you adapt to the weather, you adapt to the handling of the car, to the response of the engine. But it's a constant development, and that goes not just for the engineer and the crew working on the car, but it also goes for the driver. The driver just adapts as you go along. So the approach comes with adapting yourself, really. That's all I can say. The cars were completely different. You have a normally aspirated engine against a turbocharged engine. You had Firestones against Goodyears. Those tires definitely had different characteristics. But as far as my driving approach, that was the same. So that was, to me, in a way, also kind of interesting when I drove. And I'm kind of moving out of the question here. When I drove the IROC car at Indy,
yeah,
it was amazing to me that the way I drove Indy and my way of turning into the corners applied exactly what I applied to IndyCar, applied to that car. And that was, to me, it was like, wow, I never expected that. Basically, the real slow, how should I put it? The real delayed, slow turn-in approach that I had also applied to that IROC car.
Hmm.
So, yeah, I always try to, when I coach people, try to drivers, I like to tell them that, you know, preferably you don't want to turn in at all. Of course, you have to turn into the corner to make it, but it needs to be slow and delayed in order to scrub off less speed and to make everything more smoother and make the car go, you know, smooth and soft, so to speak, through the corner.
Next question I've got here is from Jameen Tuttle, who says, when you're watching the Indy 500 today, do you ever think to yourself, give me a fire suit, helmet, and a car, and I'll show these kids how to do it?
Yeah, that did cross my mind in past years, but lately, no, it hasn't. Well. Because I drive the two-seater every now and then, and going around the speedway the last time was in, I believe, July or August. I drove the two-seater around. I took about 40 people for rides, and I'm like, I don't know. I'm doing 180 average. I don't know if I want to go 220 or 230 average. I don't think I want to do that anymore. So, yeah, that time has passed.
All right, fair enough. Well, you got a kid, you know. Maybe that junior kid would get him back behind the wheel, represent the family.
Yeah, well, he's 36 and getting married in January, so I don't know. He's got other things on his mind for sure.
Excuses,
I think that boat has passed.
All right. Next one here. We got a couple of questions along these lines, and I know you'll do your best to answer them, but it's folks asking here. David Simmons, for example, says, can you tell the real difference between the 236, the 236-mile-an-hour averages you did back in the 90s there versus the 230s they run today? And again, I'll just mention, it's been a few years since Ari's raced the Indy 500, so it's not as if you've been out in a 2018 spec DW12 to compare and contrast, but at least from your last times racing at the Speedway, is there any real difference, you know, 5-6 miles an hour from one car to the other, or is it that speed, is it all just feeling very similar?
In a way, it feels similar, but the speed difference is there, of course. But what happens, your whole body, your head, so to speak, what I always found out when I went back to the Speedway, we would do Phoenix race, we would do Long Beach, and then we would end up in Indy. And then that first 10 laps going around, I always had to kind of, my body had to also come up to speed because the speed is so much higher than the other racetracks. And then once you've got that kind of in your system, you notice the speed, but the speed is not a one of those things like, wow, I'm going really fast thing, you know. You're very relaxed behind the wheel, and you focus on making the car work, doing the best lines, and it becomes automatic almost. And so when you have a car that is capable of doing 236, 237, and you are then doing laps of 230, yeah, then you notice the difference because you're like, man, I'm going slow now. I better, you know, let's see what's going on. But from year to year, you don't really notice that difference because you're focusing your mind, your body, your senses are all tuned into doing 228. And then one year, the year before, you were doing 236, and your body and your senses were used to that kind of speed. So you only notice the difference when from one day to the next you slow down by 5 miles an hour and you're scratching your head and you think, what's going on? The car feels really slow coming off of four, and it feels really slow going through the corner because it's, you know, scrubbing off speed or something. But it's really from a day-to-day thing.
All right, two more Indy 500 questions for you, my friend. This one's from Stephen Kilsdonk. He says, it's easy to point to the 1994 Ilmor Mercedes pushrod engine as the last wild, unbridled, outside-the-box design to be allowed at Indy. What did Ari think of it when it was announced and when you were competing against it in retrospect?
Well, seeing them go around and seeing them being that fast, it was like shocking, and it's pretty much you knew that you couldn't compete against it. So, but that was typical Indy back in those days where, you know, Penske would come out with something like that, and they kept it really quiet and secret. And that was kind of cool, you know, those are those cool moments in racing where you're like, man, you know, those guys really were able to do that. But the rules allowed for that, of course, and we don't have that anymore. So yeah, those innovations were just was like the Farnelli car, and what was it, 60?
Yeah, the turbines and such.
The turbine, you know, things like that. That's what really gave Indy that extra history, special history that that doesn't exist anymore, because it's just not realistic anymore to have these out of control, wide open rules, and people can just do what they come up with. So those times are over.
Let's go to our last Indy 500 question, coming from Brian Smith. He says, with the push to raise horsepower in IndyCar over the next couple of years, does Ari think his track record, qualifying record, is in jeopardy? And if so, how would you feel about it being taken by someone else?
Well, I've always said, and through the years, that I would love to see somebody break that record, because I think it would be really cool to hear that announcement over the speakers. You know, it's a new track record. That would bring back a lot of memories, I think, for a lot of people, because that was part of Indy. The increased search for more speed as the years went by. Then, of course, in 96, I did have that record, and then in 1997, we slowed down by about 20 miles an hour. And if they would have let them keep on increasing the speeds by keeping the same RPMs and things like that, or increasing RPMs, they probably would have broken that record a long time ago. So it's just a matter of, in my opinion right now, more horsepower. And I know they're going to increase the horsepower. I don't know, was it 220 they're going to do that? So that it's potentially possible that they could break that track record.
Yeah, 21 are supposed to get new engines, 22 are supposed to get new cars. So, and the big thing about this current formula since 2012 is it's been a low power formula, low boost formula on the super speedways. So compared to the road courses where we have lots of boost, today folks are saying 750 plus horsepower. That gets knocked down quite a bit on the super speedways. So hundreds of horsepower less than cars have had previously. So the fact that they're going as quickly as they are, I think, is granted. We might not be setting trap speed records these days, but the cornering speeds are just phenomenal to set those average speeds. So, definite appreciation.
Yeah, to give you an idea, back when I was doing, we were able to run 238, and it all depends on how nice the weather is and no wind and et cetera, and temperatures, but when I did run 238, the minimum speed in the corner was 234. So basically, we never got below 234. And the thing was, which was amazing to me, every time we found something to make us go quicker down the straightaway, which is reducing wing or putting a flat wheel instead of a regular wheel on the car, which covers. We did in 19th. We would pick up a mile an hour down the straight because of those wheels, and then we would see on the data that we also picked up a mile an hour through the corner. So those are things were really cool to experiment with and look at. But yeah, so the cars right now are aerodynamically so much more efficient than in my time that they can achieve these speeds with a little bit of horsepower that they have now, 7 plus, whereas back then we had 900 plus, and they're only, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 miles an hour off. So it just shows you the efficiency of the aerodynamics that they have going on right now, which is just amazing.
Let's move over to two sports car questions, of which I love these, and maybe we'll spend some more time in the future talking nothing but sports cars, Ari. First one comes in from Greg Liversedge, who says, I believe in 1992 you drove for Jaguar Laguna Seca. What was it like to drive the Jag XJR14? How did it compare to an IndyCar of the day? And he says he remembers as a 10-year-old kid, your driver's suit went missing at a race. He says, I seem to recall them making announcements over the PA system for whoever stole it to return it. Did it ever show up, and did you have a backup?
Yeah. That was actually a driver's suit that Jaguar, they had the sponsorship of Bud Light, and they didn't make me a suit, so I borrowed a suit from Davy Jones, who was the other driver in the team. Yeah, I hung it out to dry after one of the sessions, and it never came back, so somebody still has that suit. But the car was really cool. It had the Ford normally aspirated V8 in it.
F1 engine, yeah.
And it was basically the same motor they used in the Benetton in the 90s, early 90s, in the Benetton F1 car. It had a lot of torque, and it was really grunty. It felt really cool. The problem with for me back then, and it was always something that kind of irritated me, was the lack of preparation. Showing up at Laguna and then driving it for the first time on, I believe, a Friday. And I had made a seat for the car in the shop, but the car was just too small for me. You know, guys like Fabi and Derek Warwick and even Davy Jones and Jan Lammers, guys like that, they were all small, and they fit perfectly in that car. And the problem for me was my head was up against the roll bar of the roof, basically. My knees were wedged under the dashboard, and my elbow was hitting the back of the bulkhead, shifting gears, left hand shifting gears, to the point where in the race I didn't even bother using second anymore because I couldn't get it in half the time because my elbow would be hitting the bulkhead and I couldn't move my hand more inward to make my arm shorter, basically. So that was kind of irritating. So I finished the race. I finished fourth, but it was not a memorable finish. But the car was definitely a really cool car. Always loved driving sports cars and the Nissans and the Porsche 962, which I drove one time. Always loved driving those things. I always thought they were way more physical than an Indy car.
Mm.
Because of the heat inside the cockpit, and it was quite a challenge, and it was always for me a really good warm up to the season. Basically, Daytona and Sebring were in the beginning of the year, and we had not raced in IndyCars yet, so to get the cobwebs out was perfect practice to do those two races in the beginning of the year.
Well, we'll spend some more time talking about the XJR14 in the future for a dedicated podcast on sports cars. The next question here from David Hopkins says, "Hi, Ari, can you tell us your memories of driving the Nissan prototype at Le Mans, especially before the Mulsanne chicanes were introduced?"
Yeah, that was also one of those deals where we had no testing and we went to Le Mans. And I remember it was amazing. The first time I drove the car, and I was the first, shared the car with Chip Robinson and Jeff Brabham. And it was the Group C car. And I was the first to drive the car. And as I went out on the track, and back then we didn't go out and rent a car to drive around the track or learn it. We couldn't do much simulation. And we didn't walk the track, so basically I got onto the track, and that's how I learned the track. And started going around a few laps, and then I couldn't go flat out on the straightaway in that first session. And I came in after two laps, and I said, well, if you guys don't fix something here, I'm going home, because basically I was scaring myself going down the Mulsanne straight because the car was pretty much all over the place. It wouldn't drive straight. It was darty. The back end felt really light. So I couldn't even go flat out on the Mulsanne straight. And I'm like, wait a minute. You know, straightaways are supposed to be easy.
All the things you want at 240 miles an hour.
Yeah, well, I wasn't doing 240 because I wasn't even in top gear. That thing was all over the place. So
Wow. We
came in and they changed everything. The springs. The springs were way too soft in the front. So once we finally got it right, the Mulsanne straight was just way too long, and you sat there for I don't know how long, going literally 240 plus. In the race, I remember looking down, I'm going 248, And I'm thinking, boy, if I blow a tire right now, I'm toast. And that was my biggest fear, that something mechanically would happen while you're going down a 3 mile straight at 240 plus. So I was happy it didn't rain that weekend, because I was kind of not looking forward to rain on the Mulsanne straight in between a bunch of slower cars as well. That's the big danger there, I think, in Le Mans. So yeah, it was quite an experience, but it was not a relaxed weekend, just because the car wasn't developed yet. It was edgy. It wasn't good on the brakes. So, but with a car that's really just set up perfect, I'm sure it's a lot of fun.
Well, let's move on to some of our general questions, and there are some gems in here as well. Let's start with Tom Cottle, who asks, who's faster in the two-seater, you or Mario?
Yeah, that's funny. Well, one time we were driving the two-seater at the Indy GP, and it was wet. And Mario has always been aggressive, and he still is. I don't know, I think he's 76 now.
Yeah.
But a couple of years ago, so let's say he's 72 or 73. And he leaves the pits, and he's burning out, and he's going. I'm like, Jesus, you know, Mario, you're making me work hard here, because it's only a two-seater ride. It's not supposed to be racing. So I decided to kind of get into it, and I pulled up to him, and I pulled alongside, and I kind of outbraked him and showed him, like, okay, I can keep up with you. Just chill out. And then that's what he did. He chilled out, and then the pace was a little lower. So, but it's funny how he's always aggressive, and it's fun to watch.
I love it. I love the two of you. Andrew C. says, Ari, can you tell us your favorite or best Dick Simon story? He says, although I was very young when you ran for Dick, he says, I love the photos of those black and gold Pravini Veal cars, and especially the years that you ran for Mr. Simon. So you have a fun Dick Simon story you can share with us?
Yeah, Dick Simon was really a great guy. He was able to put together such a good team with limited funds. And we had great setups a lot of times at the 500. And a favorite story, well, Dick used to talk a lot. People who know Dick Simon know that he's sometimes, I call it, has a verbal diarrhea. And so one time on the radio, he's talking. It was Michigan 500, and I just got, you know, I'm trying to drive, I'm trying to focus, and Dick is just talking, and I just, with about 20 laps to go, I just pulled the radio plug out of my helmet. I'm like, okay, I'm done. So I just pulled the radio out, and I come in, and Dick is like, what happened? I tried to tell you this, and I tried to tell you that, and like, I don't know, Dick, I don't know what happened, lost all radio contact. So that's kind of like, you know, I'm not the biggest talker, but and compared on a scale of 1 to 10, I might be a 4. Dick is a 10. So sometimes that didn't always work out. But he was a great guy. But he just, as a team owner, he would take on so much that it would take away from my program or Scott Brayton's program. He was always hustling stuff, but he was a great guy. He's exactly 20 years older than me. We have the same birthday, September 21st. So I'm 65 and he's 85.
Wow.
So, yep, he's getting up there in age. Still working.
I need to go down and visit him for a day and capture a podcast with him just about his life and career, because he's such a fascinating guy.
Yeah, but you'll need 2 hours of broadcast time.
Oh, well, yeah. And I do love the fact that there was definitely spotty radio connections, though, during your time driving for him. Michael Offrey asks, did the split damage any personal friendships he had with drivers or crew or team owners who remained on the kart side?
Yeah, I saw that question on Twitter yesterday, and I go, that's interesting. You know what? No, it did not. Not even one bit. And I never felt that way. And I never let anybody else make me try to feel that way. So I basically drove IRL because I wanted to drive the 500. Plus, I was a realist. I still am. realistic about the fact that I had maybe one offer to drive, and I wasn't too keen about that offer to stay in kart. It would have meant for me to be like a test driver for the new Toyota engines coming in, and it would have meant driving in the back. And at my age, because already then I was 40 plus, I didn't want to be a test driver for a new engine coming into the series.
Sure.
With the possibility of going into turn one and blowing up a motor at some fast oval. And, you know, so I just deliberately chose for the IRL side for those two reasons. And I never let it be, you know, IRL or kart. I used to go to a lot of kart races during the IRL season, the first one, and after that as well. So I've always kept a great relationship with Chip Ganassi and used to go to all the races and hang out with those guys. And I never let them pull me into a corner and try to choose sides, so to speak. I just chose that side for me, for my career.
The next question, which comes in from Michael Goodyear, actually involves our man Chip. He says, Ari is one of the few drivers to race against Chip Ganassi and then proceed to drive for his team and win your first pole at Indy with them. Knowing Chip as a competitor first, what was it like to be part of the team at the very beginning? And he asks, could you tell even then from those early days that his team would develop into the powerhouse it is today?
You know, I don't remember too much about driving against Chip. I did a couple of races against him, and he was driving Super Vs back in the day in 81, going that back that far. Yeah, I never really hung out with Chip much, but once he became a team owner, that's when I probably was talking to him more than when he was driver. Yeah, because he had that big crash in Michigan in 83, I think it was, or 84, I'm not sure, with Alonso Jr. in Michigan.
Yeah.
So his driving career was very short because of that, and he came back a few times, I believe, with the Machinist Union in Indianapolis.
Yep.
Yeah, and that team, obviously, that team back then wasn't very competitive, so in that regard, yeah, it was just, you know, he would come just to do Indy, and so no, I never really discussed or talked to him much during his driving days. But as far as the team being, you know, being the powerhouse it became, yeah, you know, they had their quite a few years to become that team, and unfortunately I kind of missed it by 1 or 2 years being there. But when I was there with Maurice Nunn as our engineer, and then later Julian was a great guy to work with, very smart, and he kind of helped us transform the car towards the end of the season to be more competitive. But by then it was too late, and Chip already had signed Michael, so I was out. And then after that, they obviously became the powerhouse they are. But I've always had a really good relationship with Chip, and to this day. In fact, we had lunch yesterday.
Nice. Let's go to a question from Dr. Ed Potkanowicz. Hi, Ed. He says, can Ari please comment on the differences in a driver's physical preparations today compared to what drivers did in your era? And can you also please share thoughts on the differences in the physical demands of driving then versus now?
Well, I wouldn't know that now because I'm not driving, but the preparation is way better now than it ever used to be. I mean, everybody has a personal trainer. They have this specially designed fitness regime. They have diets. They go to... I mean, they're just full-time professional athletes. We were as well, but we didn't go to the extent they do now to become and to stay fit.
What was your regimen back when you were kind of, you know, really raging in the late 80s, you know, through the 80s and 90s and such? Did you have kind of a standard preseason routine or in-season routine?
You know, I did have my routine, and looking back, it was totally, you know, it wasn't that good. But I did my 1 hour of cardio, like five times a week. I did my, you know, my weight training, but looking back at it, it was definitely not enough. Basically, driving those cars was really physical. I think that the cars were more physical then than they are now. We should have been in better shape. But it just, I don't know, that cult, it's a different culture now, let's call it that.
Yeah.
Amongst the drivers. I guess we did the best we could, but we weren't that fanatic about it, about getting fit. And the funny thing is, a lot of races back in the day, towards the end, I'd be pretty, as we call it, knackered, pretty tired. But you kind of like mind over matter it. And I always was trying, you know, I was always proud of the fact that I could put out the same lap times the last five laps of the race that I could in the beginning. And you did that because you had to go as fast as you could all the time, even with a guy on your gearbox or a guy not on your gearbox, just to show the team that you still had the speed towards the end of the race. So you're always showing your capabilities no matter what, because you were always fighting basically for your job. That's how kind of the industry is. You know, you're only as good as your last race, your last lap. And so there was a lot of mind over matter, and I think these days the guys are just fitter, because it's a different culture.
Let's see. You've got a couple questions here. One from I Forgot My Password Okay on Reddit, saying they only started paying attention to IndyCar in 2014, was asking how you could retell the story of how you came into IndyCar, and I'll actually refer back to a podcast you and I did, I don't know, maybe 2 years ago, talking about your early days and coming into racing over here. So just suggest that maybe go and listen to that, because you'll get a really cool story of Ari coming over and racing in Super V and such, and then working in IndyCar. Another question here, more of a general one about someone we're both quite fond of. This comes from Louis90, who says, Ari, I was hoping you could talk a little bit about working with your engineer, the late Tim Wardrop, during the IRL years. He says, you were a fast combination at the Speedway. What might you share about our magician friend, Mr. Wardrop?
Yeah, Doctor Who. I always called him the fifth Beatle, because he looked like one of the Beatles with his leather jacket, and then he would have his leather jacket on in pit lane at Indy. It would be a really hot day. If it was really hot, he would roll up his sleeves, and it wasn't that hot, he would have his sleeves down. But Tim and his leather jacket are almost legendary. But he was great to work with. We started working, the first time we worked together was 1987 with Hammergarn. And then the next time we worked together was 1995. So 95, 96, 7, 8, and 99. In fact, 2001 and 2002 as well at Indy. So we had a long relationship. We really felt each other. We knew what we wanted from the car, of course. And the working relationship was very good. In the end, Tim started to lose some of his magic, I think. But I think that had to do with his personal struggles. But when he was on top of his game, it was great, because basically I would ask him, we would have a great setup going, we'd be really quick, and then Tim said, well, you know, I think we can try this or this. And I'm like, well, are you sure? Because I'm the one who has to turn into turn one at 2:35. No, he says, trust me, it'll be fine. And I would just totally trust him on the setup change, and it would be good. And we had that couple of years there, 95 through 97, where it was really, really good working with him.
See, I'm going to jump to a couple of more general questions, and then we will move on to our closer. A couple folks have asked about Texas 1997. That sucker's going to follow you everywhere, my friend. But, you know, as Montoya likes to say, it is what it is. Kevin Frederico asks, Ari, can you tell us about your favorite car that you've raced throughout your career, no matter what it was?
Whatever car was handling the best.
Mm.
I don't care what it looks like. I don't care what it sounds like. But if I think back to the best handling car at the Speedway, it would be the Raynard Cosworth from 1996. And I was very upset, obviously, when the whole qualifying thing went down, where we had to go to the backup car and they didn't weigh it, and then it was overweight and got disqualified. And then in the race when I got taken out. I was upset about that whole thing, but the car, just as a car and handling, that was my car. That I would say it was the best car that ever felt the best to me. Another one was, you know, it was the Lola in 1998, where Phoenix, we were leading, and the car at that day was also just unbelievable. I could do anything with it. I could literally four-wheel drift that thing into turn one and two at PIR, and it wasn't a problem. Of course, we had the fire, and we lost out. We didn't win that race, but we should have. We could have. Yeah, so there's so many cars that they have their moments. So it's really not about the actual car. It's about how did the team and the engineer, how did we as a team make it handle, and that then really stands out in your mind. What's your favorite car?
Next question is from one of your countrymen, and I might have been mispronouncing his last name this whole time, so maybe you can correct me here. First name is Michael. I got that part. Last name is spelled Breedijk. How would we pronounce his last name correctly?
V-R-I-E and then?
B-R, B as in boy, R, E-E, D as in dog, I-J-K.
No, I didn't get that, actually.
Breedijk, possibly? Breedijk, I'm not sure.
Breedijk.
Possibly.
B
as in boy, yes.
Breedijk.
All right, there we go. Michael Breedijk says, the last days there's been a lot of talk about a return to F1 to Zandvoort. How big is the change would need to happen, and what do you think might need to be done to the track to make it worthy for F1 to return?
Well, the last time I drove there, it seemed a bit narrow from that perspective, but a lot of tracks seem that way when I go on them. Like this year I drove the two-seater at Elkhart Lake, and I hadn't been on the track since 94, and I'm like, wow, it's pretty narrow. So they all seem narrow to me, and maybe it's just me and the eyesight. Mm. But no, Zandvoort, I don't know, it seems a bit short. It could be a bit longer, but it could work. There wouldn't be any passing, but it could work. So,
well, Michael also mentions a last short one about Zandvoort. He says, at that track, there's the Ari Lyndike corner. He says, if you could choose one corner in the USA or Canada that you've raced on to have named after you, which corner would it be at which track?
Which corner named after me on an American track? Nah, I couldn't answer that.
All right.
Too many corners, too many racetracks.
Well, maybe folks can send us some notes on social media. Let us know.
Yeah, it's definitely an honor when that happened. It's kind of weird. In the Netherlands, Zandvoort, the corner coming onto the straightaway is named after me. So I went there with my kids, my twins. This is about 12 years ago. And I went to that corner and didn't say anything to them that That's the R line, that corner.
Hmm.
And the whole time they go, "Dad, what? Why do I hear your name the whole time?" I go, "Well, this is the R line, that corner," and they thought that was kind of cool. Of
Well, that's better than standing next to the, you know, one of the portable toilets and having them say, "Hey, this is named after you." So, got an interesting one here, Ari, from Bobby Rooney. Curious about your new role in race control a little bit. He says, "How has your driver's perspective changed from when you experienced races in the cockpit to how you experience them now as a race steward?" So, that's an interesting one, right? I mean, you've gone from one end to the other now.
Well, I always said when I started doing this job with IndyCar, being a race steward, I said, now I'm the guy I used to hate. So, definitely a different perspective. I think it was 2011 in Kentucky. I asked Brian Bonner, I said, "Hey, can I come up and see what's going on in race control?" And I came away going like, man, no idea. And that's the thing with obviously most drivers right now, they have no idea what it takes to run a race, and I had no idea, because you just, you know, you're busy with your thing, with your team, and that's it. It's all, as a driver, you go to the racetrack, you work with your guys, with your team, and that's pretty much your world. You don't concern yourself with, you know, the schedule of the race, the rules, the technical rules, all those things. So being in that role has obviously broadened my horizon as far as racing in general. So I love it. I really enjoy being involved with IndyCar. What I like the most of it is really working with the drivers, trying to inform them of like, hey guys, you know, if you do this, it's in the rule book, you're going to do this, you're going to get a penalty, so let's stay away from, you know, this line and this deal. And so I think the difference between what Max Pappas and I do as opposed to previous guys in that role is we actually are proactive on Friday and Saturday and making sure that everybody, all the drivers, understand, you know, these are the consequences if you do this. So we try to constantly make them aware of that, because a lot of these rules are what they are. They're just rules, and a lot of times as a driver you get heated and you're aggressive and you're racing, and sometimes you forget about these little rules things, and then they could bite you. And so it's just really interesting. It's amazing how every weekend we learn stuff. We go like, oh, okay, maybe we should tweak this rule a little bit. Maybe we should tweak that, because what I like to see is no penalties at all, because I think exceeding the speed limit in the pits, for instance, to me has nothing to do with racing. That's strictly a safety call, and we have to enforce it because of safety for the crews in the pits. And we've hardly had any calls the last couple of years, but it really hurts to have to announce that, for instance, in Portland, you know, Scott Dixon, you're going to get a drive-through penalty because you were speeding in the pits. And we hate to do those things, but that's kind of black and white. And other rules, we like to, you know, we like to be fair. So that's the name of the game.
And we have Bobby with a follow-up question, and Henri Fong has also asked one similar in this vein, talking about maybe just sharing thoughts on personal opinions and how things have evolved, knowing that back, you know, in the 80s and 90s, it seemed more often that if a driver is using the chrome horn or had avoidable contact, you know, it seemed to be something that was more policed on the racetrack or among drivers afterwards, whereas today it seems like there's a lot more regulations, formal reviews of situations, penalties. Just curious how you feel about that evolution of one being, you know, kind of heavy, rule-based governance, and the other one being a little less formal, you know, let's handle it ourselves on track or out of the cockpit?
Well, when you look at the 90s, you'd go out to qualify, and you'd be on your second hot lap where the tires were up to temperature and the pressures were up, and now you're going for it, and you almost complete your lap, and then there's a guy in your way, and he screws your lap. Back then, you kind of like go, you were mad, but it was just part of it. You had to try to position yourself to where that wasn't going to happen, but that didn't always work out, and you kind of shrugged it off and go like, okay, oh, whatever, so, you know, you moved on. But it happened, it started happening so much that rules had to be written for qualifying, yeah. Qualifying interference and those things. And then those rules are written, and then everybody's just like, oh, that guy held me up, this guy held me up, oh, he was going to hold me up. And then it becomes from one, it swings that way, now it's all about enforcing the rules. So it doesn't make it any easier for race control, and definitely not the race stewards. I think our biggest job is kind of a nightmare job, is qualifying.
Mm.
And it's not always one guy is holding one up, but one guy thinks he's getting held up. And anyway, sometimes it gets ugly, and we don't like that either. Sometimes we were thinking this year, like, you know what, why don't we just throw all these rules away for qualifying interference and let them figure it out. And if they get in each other's way, then too bad. And that's the way it used to be. So I think the mentality has become so much different that there's no way back to the old way. And that's good too. I mean, the old way wasn't always the good way when it comes to a lot of things.
Hmm.
Track safety, a lot of things, track safety, like, and now the qualifying interference, we didn't have that.
Well,
most things are for the better, but it is a more regulated sport, with, as far as the chrome horn, you know, taking people out. I mean, yeah, in NASCAR you see that happen, but the cars are kind of designed in a way that they can do that. And but Indy cars are not designed to take each other out, and to have fair racing. Blocking is another thing. You know, blocking was common in the 90s, 80s, 90s. You know, you just blocked the hell out of somebody. And that went on and on and on. And, you know, you knew certain drivers were practically impossible to pass because they were just amazing blockers. They knew how to put their car there where it messed you up. And so I think that's a good rule, because the blocking got out of hand, and danger, the danger aspect of it. So I don't know if I answered the question, but things have changed, and not always for the worst.
There we go. Well, let's close with Texas 97, Ari. We've got Chuck Knobb and David Crumley who've asked. Chuck was curious if you could share any interesting stories behind the scenes of the mistaken scoring confrontation with Ari. I know you've spoken about this a lot. Let's go with the one from David Crumley. He said, basically says, you know, I know that AJ was still a little bumpy about it and refused to give the trophy back, but he was curious, A, did you get a replacement trophy, and B, do you and AJ ever speak? You know, is that 97 incident water under the bridge?
Oh, yeah, that's been water under the bridge basically since 97 already, because, you know, he and I spoke about it. The whole thing was that it was just a bad deal for everybody, for them and for me, because if you, from their perspective, so I'm running third or whatever, and I'm two laps down. You know, as a team owner, like Foyt, he's not going to tell his driver to, you know, to gas it up because he's two laps ahead. So he's got a cushion in hand. So Billy Boat was protecting his lead basically, but he wasn't really racing for the lead. So from that perspective, you know, he didn't have to, because they were thinking like, we got this in the bag. from my perspective, my guys would keeping on telling me, like, hey, they'll correct this later. Keep on going. You know, you're basically racing Tony Stewart for the lead. And I got up to Tony, and I think I passed him. And then later he, I don't know what happened, if he blew a motor before or after, I'm not sure. But I remember racing Tony really hard. I was right on his gearbox, so close, and I was just furious the whole time. It made me so mad, the whole thing, that every time I come in the pits, I would lose a lap. We knew we were leading, but obviously, Ford's guys knew they were leading because that's what it showed. And so it didn't work out for both of us in the end. I think it was, you know, they were in winner's circle. I was all mad and getting mouthy, and then Ford came up behind and he smacked me on the head, and like, what the hell is that? I thought it was a camera hitting me. And it was just, you know, in the end, it was like, man, this was quite a scene. But we spoke the next day. He called me and apologized for getting out of hand, you know, getting AJ on me. So, but of course, the press loved it and they went with it, and they still do, actually. Every year we go back to Texas, Eddie Gossage has to bring it up because he just thinks it's so cool. So, you know, it's the legacy of the Texas Motor Speedway, I guess. It has become that.
Well,
but I guess AJ has the trophy. I mean, he has the trophy, but I got a replacement trophy.
All right, good.
The following year, Eddie Gossage did a whole thing. I got my driver's suit on from the year before, and we did a whole presentation of the trophy. So yeah, I do have a trophy, but that race will always have an asterisk to it because it was just wild and crazy.
Well, always been one of my favorite wild and crazy people, Mr. Leyendyke. Thanks for taking some time, even migrating from home to the car here on your way to an appointment. But yeah, really appreciate you setting some time aside for us and IndyCar fans, and also appreciate all the great questions that have come in from everyone on Facebook, Twitter, and Reddit. And we'll look forward to speaking to you next week on the next episode of The Week in IndyCar, presented by Cooper Tires.